The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Best of bumper music known to man, nearly 7 years running. It's time now for the second hour of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show here on News Talk 710 KNUS. Happy Independence Day, one and all. And as I hear Robin Trower sing about the fool and me, I think about the fools who believe that government involvement in higher education financing. I think about how foolish they really are, because government involvement in higher ed has driven the cost crisis that we now face and have for years. It's just precipitously gotten worse and worse. That's why on Friday's edition of my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner, Jimmy at the Crossroads, which, by the way, you can subscribe to online. On YouTube, youtube.com/Jimmy at the Crossroads, I caught up for Free to Choose Friday with Dr. Richard Vedder, a noted economist and scholar on higher ed costs. I mean, let's put it into perspective this way, $345 billion, that's where student loan debt was at in about 2004. By the end of last year, it was at over $1.6 trillion. I'm not good at math, but that is an astronomical jump. How do we get here? How did we get to this point? I caught up with Dr. Richard Vedder to talk about exactly that just yesterday. And I want to dive in to some of the specifics of how we reached this point and also some of the negative consequences of the student loan debt crisis with a leading economist on this issue, Dr. Richard Vedder, PhD economist, distinguished emeritus professor of economics at Ohio University, a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, and also the original director for the Center on College Affordability and Productivity. He joins us now to dive into this very topic. Professor, welcome to the show. It's good to have you.
Glad to be back with you, Jimmy.
Good to talk with you again. And if you wouldn't mind maybe scooching over just a smidge to your left, I think, and then that will make you a little bit more focused into the shot there. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. So it's good to have you here. I know you caught a little bit of my monologue and some of the things that I was saying, but I'd love for you to synopsize for us, please, what your extensive research, and you've done a heck of a lot on this topic, Professor, what it shows about how we got to the point where we have over $1.6 trillion in student loan debt, with the average borrower coming out of college with nearly $40,000 in debt.
Yeah. Well, the reason why we have so much student loan debt is it's so easy to get borrow money from the federal government, as I think you had a segment on by Milton Friedman. Friedman decades ago said this. The government, and Bill Bennett said it, and we all have said it, that if going to college is affordable by people being able to borrow, colleges will see this. They'll say, hey, great, we can just jack up our prices. And we can capture that money, not the students, rather the universities and the colleges. And so the research done by the New York Federal Reserve Bank, the National Bureau of Research, Economic Research, and other organizations show that for every dollar more that students borrow from the federal government, colleges and universities usually raise their tuition by about two-thirds of that, by, say, 65 cents out of every dollar. So the big gainers from the student loan programs have not been the students. It's been the colleges. And then what do the colleges do with all that money? Well, they spend it on themselves. By that, I mean they hire more administrators. They pay them higher salaries. They engage in a bunch of social engineering projects that are near and dear to the faculty and to other administrators. Diversity and inclusion coordinators, sustainability experts, PR people, all of this. And they jack up the price of colleges. Who are the big losers? Students. And ironically, low-income students. The proportion of kids graduating from college these days, meaning the last 2, 3, 5 years, coming from the bottom quartile of the income distribution, the bottom 25%, that proportion is lower today than it was when the student loan programs were getting underway in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And the reason is college low-income kids see big sticker prices to colleges. That scares a lot of them away. They say, there's no way we can afford that. Sure, maybe we'll get some scholarship aid. Maybe they'll discount our fees some. But we don't know for sure what that's going to be. Maybe we ought to skip college. So the big losers are low-income people. Mm-hmm. And by the way, minority groups who tend to be below average in income also suffer. Yeah. And so the big losers are, to be blunt about it, African-Americans, blacks, Hispanics, other low-income people, recent immigrants to the United States, the people who allegedly we were trying to help when we started these programs in the first place.
Well, to emphasize that point, I want to put up pick four, Dr. Richard Vedder, and this includes reference to some of the research that you have done. What we see is some of the data demonstrating this point. So first of all, Brookings Institution came out with a study back in early 2018 saying that it's at crisis levels, according to this study about higher education student loan debt. Using college entrance from 1995 to 96 and 2003 to 2004 as guides, so a little outdated, but still, the report finds that nearly 40% of borrowers may default on their student loans by 2023, and it observes a striking racial disparity as well. Black BA graduates default at 5 times the rate of white BA graduates, 21% versus 4%, and are more likely to default than white dropouts. And also, and this is quoting from a paper I wrote in 2018 for the Millennial Policy Center on higher ed costs and student loan debt, quote, as Dr. Vedder, our guest here, Christopher Denhart and Joseph Hartke have noted, the original reason student aid programs were created was to make college more accessible for those in lower income brackets. Yet this has been an abject failure, contributing to greater income inequality. Strikingly, quote, in 1970, the bottom quartile of families by income accounted for 12% of total bachelor's degrees received by age 24. but those families only accounted for 9.4% in 2010. This is in large part because federal student aid programs have pushed up the cost of college to the point where many low-income students can no longer afford to attend. They are, in effect, priced out of the system. And not only that, I want to add this in. In addition, higher ed institutions have adjusted their need-based aid downward in favor of merit-based scholarships, given the existence of governmental programs like Pell Grants. Finally, lower-income students have a higher dropout rate than those families who are more affluent. This means that those students who do drop out have fewer economic opportunities before them, often while shouldering a relatively high debt burden, exacerbating income inequality. Professor Richard Vedder, how does the student loan system, as we're discussing, the way it is set up at the federal level, how does that system lead to the kinds of results that we're talking about here, particularly when it comes to minority communities and, broadly speaking, those in lower income groups?
Well, this is, of course, an extremely timely topic. We're spending a lot of time these days talking about the treatment of minority groups in the American population. I would argue that the American government has done less than zero. They've been on balance harmful to minority groups in the United States. And this goes beyond higher ed issues. Of course, there are other things, the welfare system and other dimensions that go beyond the line of questioning we're going into today. But we have enticed a lot of people to go to college because they have heard nothing but you got to go to college. You can't be a success in life unless you go to college. So we push a lot of people to do that, and they do. And we get many of those going to college are coming from schools where they have poor preparation. Some of them are encouraged to go in spite of the fact that the probability of their succeeding is very, very low. But hey, if they flunk out of college, the colleges don't lose anything. They get their tuition money. The students maybe end up with a large loan payment that it's very difficult to make, particularly given the fact that they are not able to get very good jobs. They're college dropouts. They're stigmatized because, they couldn't quite succeed in life. They dropped out of college. So this is psychologically debilitating for them as well. And so I think we have consigned a class of people into a rather miserable existence. And it didn't have to happen. Indeed, there are other ways we can finance higher education that would help people of limited incomes other than the one we're doing. And we should be focusing our attentions on getting rid of the current system, I think.
Again, Dr. Richard Vedder is our guest here on Jimmy at the Crossroads, distinguished emeritus professor of economics at Ohio University. What you're getting at more than anything is a warped incentive structure for colleges and universities to just continue providing these student loans and grants without any, or rather to accept students and keep raising tuition because they know that the flow of student loans and grants is going to continue. But also, one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that if you go to college, and say you drop out after about a year or 2 years, and you're already coming out with $25,000, $30,000 in student loan debt, or maybe even $10,000, whatever that number is, and you drop out of college, your income earning potential is significantly reduced, and you're going to be struggling to pay down that debt, meaning it will exacerbate your cycle of poverty. That is stunning and a very striking point, I think, that we need to keep in mind here, because especially in this regard, Dr. Vedder, when we talk about the student loan system, oftentimes you will hear Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others say it's because we don't have free college provided by the U.S. federal government that people are struggling like this, especially in the minority groups that we're talking about in lower income communities. So how do you respond to that sort of criticism based on the way the system actually is structured as we're discussing?
Well, yes. The answer of the individuals you named is let's give it away. Let's make it free. After all, that's what some European countries have done. They have free college or relatively low-cost college, and those countries are surviving, by the way, with generally low rates of economic growth and so forth. So let's do that. What would happen if we did that? First of all, college would become a joke in terms of the what it does. It's supposed to further the dissemination of knowledge. It's supposed to have a certain enriching qualities, raising the productivity of workers and so forth. How is that going to happen if you have lots of people go to college who are ill-prepared for college? We, as it is now, 40% of the people who enter college full-time do not graduate in 6 years. Not 4 years, not 5 years, but 6 years. 40%. So we have already a big problem. If we now said, well, we're not going to, you don't have to pay anything to go, that is like that problem is going to grow. And there are zero negative consequences to doing poorly while in college. We already have a problem that the average college student spends less than 30 hours a week on their academic studies, going to class, studying for exams, reading, writing papers, all the things college students should be doing. At one time, they spent 40, 45 hours a week doing this back in the 1960s, say. Now they spend 26, 27 hours a week. So they're partly because of grade inflation, which brings up another topic we won't get into today. But so we have a lot of people who are going to college and are underworked as it is. If we let other people in to college and just say, go, come and spend several years with us. We don't care how you perform. If you get a below average grades, well, you can still keep going to college. There's no we're not going to provide incentives for you to do well. Indeed, we are going to almost discourage that. You're going to make worse a problem that is already very serious. And we already have a large percentage of our young Americans who are most productive people. Who are the most productive people? The people in their 20s, in the 30s. They're the ones who have the most physical strength. They're the ones who have the smartest minds. They're the ones that are the future, and we're underutilizing those resources.
So what's so interesting to me is I think back. So I graduated from Regis University in Denver, Colorado in 2011. And I got out in 3 years, by the way. I worked hard to make that possible to save a good chunk of change for a Jesuit private Catholic university, small liberal arts school, about 1,500 students. It was a great experience for me. Got my start in media, doing radio there and so forth. But I remember probably 2010, I was in an economics class, and economics was my minor at Regis University, and I remember we were given this task of writing an economist as a naturalist essay, where we didn't do our, you know, research and find data, but instead we made an argument as to why we think a phenomenon is happening using economic principles. And I talked about student loan debt and the idea that the student loan system, as it's structured with the government giving out all these loans and grants and thereby encouraging the institutions of higher education to continue raising prices, I argued that point and that it was a significant thing we needed to address. And I remember, I don't remember exactly what the professor was saying, but she said I was wrong because of something called social demand. In other words, that there's a need for society to have highly educated people. Therefore, we should just keep throwing money at it, keep doing this kind of thing of the government providing support, which I don't recall her directly refuting the argument as to why prices were going higher and higher for students trying to go to school when it comes to tuition because of the student loan system. But that's a big point that they raise is, look, we just have to provide more government support because society needs it. It is beneficial to society. But as I pointed out in my monologue, Dr. Vedder, basic market principles like supply and demand do not go by the wayside simply because you deem a particular service beneficial.
Yeah. Now, I would add one thing, added point here that I think is interesting. The people on the left, like the ones you mentioned earlier, Senator Sanders or Warren and so forth, often will point out, well, college graduates on average make a third more or 50% more, or often 100% more than high school graduates. And if we just have everyone go to college, we'll increase everyone's income more and it'll increase economic growth. But this ignores the fact that colleges are really a screening device. They screen out the people who are productive, who are disciplined, who are hardworking, who are like you, Jimmy, and graduated in college in 3 years because you worked hard at it. It screens out those kind of people from the people who are using college as a place, a gap 5 years or 6 years between high school and life. Those people that are just during the college years. Now, if you say, oh, college is free now, you don't have to pay anything for it. What are we going to get? We're going to get more of that. We're going to get more people who go to college and linger and stay around and say, hey, the federal government is taking care of me. I'm going to stay in college as long as I can. 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. And therefore, we're going to have a very costly system, very unproductive system, and we're going to bring up a lot of younger people who are not prepared for the lessons of life and for success in life.
Back on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show, that was Dr. Richard K. Vedder. We've got more of my interview with Dr. Vedder coming up in just a few moments here on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show. That, of course, from Jimmy at the Crossroads, my web show in partnership with the Washington Examiner. JimmyattheCrossroads.com, place to go to learn more, to get content. Also, I've got a shop with t-shirts like the Still Proud. If you're proud to be an American, there's a Still Proud t-shirt right there with the American flag in a pretty cool design. Be sure to check that out on this Independence Day, JimmyattheCrossroads.com. When we return, we'll share for you the rest of my interview yesterday with Dr. Richard Vedder on student loans. But also, I'm going to talk with Zach Boren from the Urban Institute about apprenticeships and the incredible opportunity that apprenticeships actually provide more and more for Americans, and this great opportunity amidst the skyrocketing cost of college education, a great opportunity for students to get the education that they need. I spoke with Zach Boren from the Urban Institute earlier for the Jimmy Sengenberger Show, and we will share that interview in the next segment as well. Keep it right here. It's Independence Day on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show. News Talk 710 KNUS. And Thursday's also sad. The eagle flies on Friday, but Saturday I go out to play. Back here on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show, News Talk 710 KNUS. Let's share right now the rest of my interview with economist Dr. Richard Vedder. on the cost, skyrocketing cost, of a college education.
But there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal last week on that very topic. And in the piece entitled "The Disparate Racial Impact of Requiring a College Degree," which focuses on employers who are saying we must hire workers who have college degrees, they write, quote, "Research from Harvard Business School shows that degree inflation in job postings is pervasive. Example, 67% of postings for new production supervisors in 2015 included college degree requirements, though only 16% of existing production supervisors had bachelor's degrees. Degree inflation is a barrier to entry for would-be employees of any race. Among workers over 25, only 40% of non-Hispanic whites and 26% of blacks have a bachelor's degree or higher. Given the racial gap in college attainment, however, degree inflation has a disparate impact on black Americans. The impact is amplified today by the effects of COVID-19 on public health, the job market, and access to college." Fundamentally, what is so contradictory to me is Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and others who have their views in terms of the current system and the kinds of reforms that they would like to see. The way in which they go about it, that would make the system even worse, as we're talking about. But at the same time, they say we need to support Black Lives Matter. But I would contend that genuine advocates of Black Lives Matter and the movement should be arguing for fundamental reforms on a basic level to get rid of this skyrocketing cost crisis that we are facing in higher ed that is a result of how the government has been through. Okay, fine. Good intentions. Well enough. We know the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But nevertheless, as a consequence, we have seen dramatically negative impacts.
Absolutely. The cost of college today is double, triple, whatever, what it was a generation ago. Exactly how much the increase is depends on how you measure it, but it's very, very substantial. And if, in fact, we were getting a lot of extra value out of that extra payment, I would say it's an investment in the future. So college costs more, but there's a lot of benefits from college. I don't think that's happening these days. By the way, I have been teaching since Jimmy, no offense, but I started teaching when you were about minus 25 or minus 30. I've been around for a long time. When I started teaching, for every faculty member, let's say for every two faculty members, there was one administrator or some non-academic type at colleges doing things. Some of them were useful things. You needed people to run the computer center and to work in the library, and you needed people to mow the grass and so forth. We had that, two faculty every administrator. This is true not only at my university, but this would be true nationally. Now, for every faculty member, there are more than one administrator. There are about one and a half administrators. We have, in other words, the basic things colleges do are teaching and research. And the people who do the teaching research are now a minority group, even within the colleges, because as all this extra tuition money came in, the colleges took it and they hired more and more administrators. And this has raised the cost a lot. There are a lot of other things going on. Some people will talk about intercollegiate athletic expenses and, a variety of other things. Research that on a muck in some areas. We have professors of English writing obscure papers on obscure topics that no one reads and getting reduced teaching loads for it that they would be better off being in the classroom teaching students. I could list 100 of these problems of one sort or another. But we have ignored the students, and the federal government is largely responsible.
Yeah, make no mistake about it, that is true. One thing I'll add in is we see similar issues with K through 12 education. A few weeks ago, we were talking about K through 12 education reform, and one of the topics we hit on was administrative bloat. I mean, even as spending on K through 12 has gone up, teachers' pay is not. In some cases, teacher pay has even gone down as more administrators have been hired and taking up more and more of school budgets. And the same principle applies as you're talking about, Professor Vedder, with regards to higher education. But we've just got a few minutes left, and I want to ask you this final question. We'll bring up this final topic, at least. Maybe we'll have a couple more questions that come about as a result. But one thing that we are seeing right now is the pandemic. Coronavirus crisis across the country. It has made things very different in the year 2020 for colleges and universities across the country, most of which canceled classes, or at least canceled in-person classes midway through the second semester of the 2019-2020 school year. We're also seeing a lot of universities thinking about how they might do more online services and what have you come the fall. And there's now discussion about what this means for the bottom line of higher ed institutions as far as their financial situation, what that might mean for student debt increases because maybe the cost of college will rise or maybe the cost of college will go down. I saw one report that some colleges and universities are offering steep discounts to those students who ask. One university even saying, hey, we'll cut your tuition by 41%, which I think underscores how arbitrary the cost of college, the tuition levels often are, Professor Vedder. But what do you think are some of the potential impacts of this pandemic right now, what it could mean particularly for the cost of college?
Well, I think you're hitting on an important point. Those Jesuits at Regis did a halfway decent job with you, Jimmy. By the way, I have friends who have both taught and gone to school at Regis. It's a great school. It's supply and demand. What's happening right now to the demand for college? Well, it is down somewhat, partly for good reasons unrelated to COVID-19. A number of students going to college today is actually, even before the pandemic, was lower than in 2011. There had been some decline in enrollment already. But now it's aggravated by the risks associated with the pandemic. So the demand for higher ed is falling. The supply is big as ever. And so colleges are desperate for students. They're losing students. They're losing revenue. So what is happening? They're discounting. Let's make a deal. It's the art of the deal, as Trump would say. And if I were a parent of a student entering college this fall, I would say, well, you say the tuition is X. I can't afford X. I will come if you make it half of X or 60% of X. And a lot of parents are negotiating pretty good discounts from the tuition. And so I expect actual tuition fees collected per student will start falling because people are realizing college is no longer the great value proposition that it has been made out to be. And so this is going to lead to some reduction in spite of the student loan program. Some people are just saying no, and they've heard about the student loan program and the misery that can be created by running up a large debt and not being able to discharge the debt in bankruptcy, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm actually, that's the one thing that could lead to some positive reform, I think.
The rest of my interview available at youtube.com/JimmyAtTheCrossroads. Be sure to check it out. Okay, so let's shift gears to a related topic with our next guest here on the Jimmy Sengenberger Show. One of the big discussions that people have been having of late is of what to do about educational opportunities after you leave high school. Do you need to just go to college, or are there other ways in which people can gain skills? Of course, we hear a lot of discussion about trade schools, but what about apprenticeships? There's a new report just out from the Urban Institute and their Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population, funded by the U.S. Department of Labor, entitled the Youth Apprenticeship Intermediary Project. And this report, as they say at the Urban Institute, highlights highlights how these registered apprenticeship programs, which we will talk about, allow participants to jumpstart their careers, to learn and earn wages, and build credentials, connect with mentors, acquire workplace relevant skills, and gain academic credit toward a college degree. Zach Boren, Senior Policy Program Manager for the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute, joins us now to dive into this report. Zach, welcome to the Jimmy Sangenberger Show. It's good to talk with you.
Yeah, good to talk with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the genesis of this report. I mean, apprenticeships, oftentimes when we hear the term apprenticeships, we think of something that is maybe 100 years out of date. But clearly there's still relevancy today. Why'd you guys dive into this topic?
Right. So, you know, apprenticeships have been, you know, around in this country and active largely in the trades for, you know, since the country was started. You know, the first law that got introduced in the United States was called the National Apprenticeship Act, and that was in 1937. We're still actually working off of this same rule that oversees the national apprenticeship system for the country. And today there's about 650,000 apprentices that are actively learning a career, everything from coding to a pharmacy tech to what you might typically expect, which is an electrician or a plumber. And these apprentices are earning really good money. Actually, on average, the apprentices are doing better than college graduates when they complete their apprenticeship. Comparing about $70,000 is what an apprentice completer earns to a college graduate, which averages about $45,000. So we think it's a good opportunity for people to relook at this age-old way of getting into a job.
Yeah, one thing that I think is so important, especially in this economy, is giving people different routes to gain the skills needed to be employed in a job that will be successful for them and make a real difference in their lives. Maybe it's getting them back on their feet. Maybe it's getting them into the working world for the very first time. So from a public policy standpoint, is there anything that policymakers need to be looking at, or is this more of a social and educational thing that schools and parents and teachers and businesses need to be taking responsibility for?
Well, I think over the last two administrations, apprenticeship has really been a bipartisan issue and really continues to be, because it's about getting people into work without having to go into debt. You know, my old boss used to call apprenticeship the other college without the debt. I think that still rings true because so many young students are taking hundreds of thousands of dollars of school debt and may not be aligned with what the job market really needs. I think it's, you know, even more critical now. You know, you think about what we're dealing with COVID, and it may be an opportunity for young people to rethink about, you know, do I want to pay $50,000 to go get a online education, because that's what a lot of students are going to get next year, versus going to get an apprenticeship, which is a real job, getting paid wages while you learn a skill and an occupation that could lead you to a really great career. And the Congress and this president have both invested in apprenticeship. When I was at the U.S. Department of Labor, the budget in 2013 was $27 million. That budget now is over $200 million. And so we see a president, a Congress, and a variety of different states getting into the game and saying, this is something worthwhile to invest in, largely because of the evidence that we see, which is 90% of those that complete an apprenticeship are employed.
Once again, we're talking with Zach Boren, who's Senior Policy Program Manager in the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute. And resonating with what we're talking about here, Zach, is an opinion piece that was published in the Wall Street Journal, I think earlier this week, that said, quote, degree inflation is a barrier to entry for would-be employees of any race. American workers over 25, only 40% of non-Hispanic whites and 26% of blacks have a bachelor's or higher. Given the racial gap in college attainment, however, degree inflation has a disparate impact on black Americans. The impact is amplified today by the effects of COVID-19 on public health, the job market, and access to college. So one of the things that apprenticeships seem to me to open the door to is greater job opportunities for those who may not be able to get a college degree or may find it more difficult to obtain that degree. And then after completing an apprenticeship successfully, you could be gainfully employed with a well-paying job.
Yeah, I do believe that's right. You know, and I would say that, you know, really thinking about the opportunity to get into college, it's becoming less and less affordable. The costs of education have outpaced almost every other durable good in the country. So, you know, we're seeing that for blacks and Hispanics, that this is really becoming more out of reach, and you know, and just for people who don't have the means to take on the debt or to take the time because they have a family they have to support. So we see apprenticeships as really filling a gap for companies. So one of the companies that we're proud to be working with is John Deere, and John Deere is really creating these great opportunities for getting into welding and CNC operating and other occupations as well in their factories in Iowa, bringing on apprentices as early as 16 and 17 and earning middle-class wages right away, not having to wait to go into debt, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, coming out with zero debt you know, being able to buy that truck or that boat or living that American dream that everybody wants.
Absolutely. And one thing that this report does, again, it's called the Youth Apprenticeship Intermediary Project from the Urban Institute, is it highlights different organizations, businesses, but also organizations that are really geared towards helping to foster these apprenticeships. And one right here in Denver, Colorado is CareerWise, which supports businesses, students, and educators seeking to start programs employing young people as apprentices. Talk to us a little bit more, Zach Boren, about what kind of programs there are out there like CareerWise that help provide these opportunities for people to get apprenticeships and to partner with businesses to make those things happen?
Yeah, I had the opportunity to meet the folks at CareerWise very early on. I joined John Hickenlooper and that whole group that came from Denver to Switzerland to see the Swiss model of apprenticeships about 5 years ago now. And it's been 3 years in the making for CareerWise, in which they've been working with a variety of businesses around the Denver area and beyond. One of those that we highlight in the report is Pinnacle Insurance. Now, most people wouldn't consider Pinnacle, you know, going into an apprenticeship in insurance. Well, you know, how does that make any sense? Well, you know, this is a new area for folks to get into that doesn't require a degree to become a general insurance associate. And we've seen a lot of companies like Pinnacle, like Zurich Insurance, like the Hartford, and other big name insurance companies start to create these programs because they can't find the talent that they're looking for now, and they really need to figure out a way to grow their own. And these are good jobs and really a way to break into a good career in the insurance industry.
Once again, we're talking with Zach Boren with the Urban Institute. Just a few minutes left with you, Zach. And One thing I think is always good, we're talking about different organizations that are involved in fostering apprenticeships and some of these businesses that are doing things in terms of offering apprenticeship opportunities and so forth. But I think something else to underscore might be a couple of real world experiences or what the response is from those who go into these types of programs and then come out with jobs with greater opportunities than they had before. Can you tell us one or two personalized stories?
Sure. Yeah, we did a report on Iowa youth apprenticeships, and we met two really neat apprentices there. One was Maya, who had started her apprenticeship in her junior summer, and she just completed her high school. She just got her high school diploma, and along the way, she got to work at a really cool supplier of John Deere. And she is now a professional welder. And now you don't think of a lot of young women thinking about getting into the welding industry, but Maya was fired up about this opportunity to get started early in her career. And she's already on track to getting into the middle class. While she was going through her apprenticeship, she didn't have to miss out on high school either. She was on the varsity bowling team. She showed heifers for FFA, and she even helped out a gardening center in the morning, getting to do some of her passions there. The other young student we met was Theo, who's an IT apprentice. He's focused in on cybersecurity at a company called Ruan. It's a transportation company in Des Moines. And he is thrilled to be coming out with more than 30 to 40 college credits along with his apprenticeship. So he's going to be continuing on with his company because, you know, in an apprenticeship, it is a job that you can continue on because you become a professional in that field. And so he was able to learn a lot from his mentor. And he told us that he was going to have 4 to 6 years of job experience by the time he finished. That is just an amazing story to think about when you think about a young high school kid just finishing high school to have that much experience already.
That's fantastic. And I'm a believer that I've used the phrase college is overrated. And I think when there are other opportunities out there for you to gain the skills and experience and credentials that you need to be successful, you should be looking at them. So the final question I have for you before I ask you where people can go to learn about the report is, what else folks need to know about apprenticeships if this might be something they'd like to consider or look into for themselves or one of their children?
Yeah, so there are a variety of different apprenticeships that are available. The U.S. Department of Labor has a website called apprenticeship.gov, and you can go to that website, and they have an apprenticeship finder where you can enter your zip code and search around your home to find out if there's an apprenticeship near you. You can also call your state office. Every state has an office of apprenticeship that is willing to help students and help employers get started. Our organization helps out a variety of different companies as they want to get started in an apprenticeship to invite students and even older workers into these apprenticeships. So the Urban Institute and our Youth Intermediary Project, we helped stimulate over 250 apprentices last year, and we continue to do that into this new year. And so you can go to our website at www.urban.org and search apprenticeship, and you can find us. You can also email us at apprenticeship@urban.org.
Zach Bourne with the Urban Institute. So great to talk with you today. Thanks so much for joining us here on 710 KNUS.
Thank you.
All right, that'll do it for the second hour of the Jimmy Sangenberger Show, the third hour on this Independence Day 2020, up next here on 710 KNUS.